Accession number 34702, reel 8.
Down in reel 8.
Well, in 1956, we took our turn to go to the Malayan detachment.
Can you tell me first off, then, with that, how you got out there and what the sort of, because it's quite a long flight, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we flew the aircraft out there, and we had a Comet accompanying us with the ground crew and that sort of thing, and I can see from my logbook it was Binbrook to Idris to Habaniya in Iraq, Habaniya to Moripur in Pakistan, Moripur to Negumbo in Ceylon, as it was then, and then from there to Butterworth. That was how we got out there.
So would you make these in sort of a day jump? Would that be...
Yes. We set off on the 12th, and we got there on the 16th. So it was 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, a leg each day, yes.
And I take it they're quite long legs that you were doing, were they, between those? Idris's Egypt, is it?
Yes. Some of them were 3 hours, most of them 3 hours 20, 3 hours 30, something like that, each leg.
And you said this is a detachment of the squadron rather than the whole squadron, is it?
No, it was the whole squadron. Yes. Yes, 12 aircraft, I think, we had then. What we used to do, we would take off 3 Canberras, loaded up with 1,000-pound bombs. We'd be given instructions where to go, and then we'd be in contact by an Oster, flown by the Army Air Corps, Ostermark. Ostermark was what the exercise was called. They would identify a target, go in and drop a marker, and we would go over there and drop our bombs in the jungle. Where they went, what they hit, we don't know, because the jungle would close back over the top of them. But theoretically, we were hitting communist camps, that sort of thing. So we did a few of those, and but then an emergency arose, the Suez thing. We were ordered back to base, pack up everything, go back home to get ready for the Suez affair. There was an aircraft that had been abandoned in Ceylon, waiting for a new canopy to come out. What used to happen occasionally out there was, from the very cold temperatures up top, and descended down quite quickly to hot temperatures down below, the canopies would crack sometimes. And this aircraft had been sitting there, abandoned there by a 617 squadron, awaiting a new canopy to come out from the UK. So a crew had to go and wait there for that to be fixed, to be brought back home again. So that was me. So we went across via the Nicobar Islands, I think, Nicobar Islands, and got stranded there because the aircraft went US. Then eventually we got to the Negumbo, as it was called then, and hung around there waiting for an aircraft to come out with this canopy on and a technician to fit it. And we hung around for quite a while, I think, one way or another.
Can I just ask before we go further on from there,
yes,
Eric, a little bit more about the time that you were in Malaya?
Mm.
the operations that you were carrying out, you know, what kind of duration were they? And was there any sort of difficulties in flying in that tropical climate?
Well, only the what we call the duty thunderstorm, which came down around lunchtime every day, which was more or less expected every day. Otherwise, the weather was reasonably good.
And the kind of duration of the operations you would fly over the jungle?
2 hours, something like that, or one case, yeah, 2 hours, 2 hours 15, something like that. 6 times 500-pound bombs. We didn't do an awful lot of operations, actually. I can see here there's all Changi in return, radar calibration, Changi in return, practice strike, flying with the Indian Navy exercise. We did other jobs, as it were, while we were there.
And with that, though, when you flew out and you said it was an Oster mark, would that be a case of you would fly out to an area and wait for them to mark the target?
That's right, the Oster would fly in low and then drop its marker.
So would you be waiting on station?
We'd be stooging around waiting. And then we'd go in formation and drop these bombs, 500-pound bombs.
Did you only feed back from those operations at all?
Well, we used to have a sort of debrief, but it was very difficult that, for them to know exactly whether we'd hit the target or whether they all scarpered off when they heard the aircraft coming. So only by sending ground people in, and that would take a long time. So by the time they checked, it's all been forgotten. We're on to the next one.
So you got out to Nagumbo and you were waiting for the canopy then, were you? And
yeah,
the technician to
that's
arrive.
Right, yeah. And I finally left there in August 1956, and I flew back via Iraq, Habania, Moripur and Idris and Bimbuk, the same route back, back to UK. The next thing was the Suez affair.
Now, did you have any time sort of for training or preparation, though, before Suez blew? Because I think it was November, wasn't it, that it happened?
Yeah, well, we came back. I got back in August, end of August. And we went out in September.
So where did you fly out to?
We flew out to Malta, Lucca Airport in Malta, where they were building up. We were going to be able to fly from Malta because of our extra range of the Cambrian B-6. So we were there with the Valiant, which was just coming into Bomber Command as well then, the first Valiants. And we hung around there and did a bit of local flying and one thing and another. Well, presumably the powers that be were making up their minds what to do and building up the forces in Malta and Cyprus, of course, which was the main build-up.
Was it quite noticeable, that build-up in Malta?
Yes, because the Fleet Air Arm were at Halfar, and their squadrons all flew off onto carriers, and we took over at Halfar with the Canberras. This was October then. So we then did our first sortie on October the 31st, where I dropped four £1,000 bombs on Kabrit in Egypt.
So can you take me through that, Eric? What was the thing? Because obviously you're going into a sort of major war here, aren't you? Because I mean, with the Malaya, it's an emergency, and essentially you're bombing sections of the jungle. Yeah. Can you take me through this stage? You know, what's going to happen at this point when you from the sort of briefing to your preparations to the actual running?
Well, it was all a bit on-off at that time. They weren't quite sure. In fact, I think one sortie was sent off and then recalled before this actual bombing happened. We were briefed because our normal load was 6 £1,000 bombs, but because of the range, we're talking about 6 hour trips, something like that, you see, which is cramped up in a camera, was rather a long time, and so we reduced the load to 4 times £1,000 in case we couldn't get off the ground. With standard bomber command briefing, we were briefed on the weather and briefed on the targets, alternative targets, that sort of thing, because we were relying on, although we were flying at 40,000 feet, we were relying on visual bombing, which was quite reasonable to expect in that part of the world, of course, that the skies would be clear, and indeed they were.
Did you have any photographs of the target at all during the briefing?
Yes, in the brief there would be photographs of the airfield, Kabrit, which was our particular target. The idea was to try and hit the runways, but whether we did or not, I don't know. Flying from 40-odd thousand feet with visual bombing, bomb sight wasn't all that accurate. We'd probably hit the airfield anyway.
And what type of formation had you flown in?
Well, with this, we're individuals. They weren't in formation this time, although we're in a stream, in other words, I suppose.
So what? Each aircraft would take a turn at the target, would they?
Yeah, yes.
And did you have any sort of escort at all?
No. No one felt we needed any at that height. And then we did another one and got on Kasfreit. That was a 5.5 hour trip. The main trouble was you got freezingly cold because being a long sortie, we had to throttle back and fly at reduced power, as it were, as long as we keep going and to get the range, and the heating, of course, subsequently was less than it would have been normally. So 5 hours odd in cramped up in the cockpit of a camera was quite a hardship by the time you got back.
And what flying gear would you wear at that stage?
Well, we were wearing the standard flying gear, flying suit, inner and outer suit, and flying boots. And gloves, of course, that sort of thing.
What about your head?
Just a helmet. And I don't know whether we were wearing bone domes in those days. I think we were, yes, by then. Yes, we were.
And was it a case, Eric, of you would just approach the target at 40,000 feet and then the bomb aimer would just
take over and
visually have to notice where that target
was. Right,
was.
Left, right, steady, and the usual stuff.
So you would just keep it on a course that he gave you.
That's
at that
right.
Point.
Yes.
At what point of the running does he really start telling you what
from
to do?
From what they call the IP, the interception point, they would take over, which would be about 3 or 4 miles from the target itself.
So when you did those run into the airfields, your bomb aimer could see them, I take it?
Yes, yes.
Was the reason for the high-level bombing, was it purely to obviously decrease the chances of interception by the Egyptian Air Force?
Yes, well, to put it out of action, in other words, or put the airfield out of action, and if any aircraft were there as well, the same thing, I suppose. At the same time, I mean, there were Canberras operating from Cyprus, Akrotiri, doing the same sort of thing, some low level and various types of attack.
And
the Valiants.
Had you marked your aircraft in any particular way for the...
No. Not like D-Day, no.
were the Canberras camouflaged, or was it at that stage?
No, they weren't camouflaged. They were silver colour, yes. Yes. Then it all came to a rather abrupt end, as you know.
How many operations had you flown on them?
I flew 2, that was all. And, then we flew back, I think, and that's right, in November, end of November. We were back at Binbrook.
So you stayed for a couple of weeks, did you, after the end of the sort of operations? Or?
Yes. We stayed around, we hung around and did a bit of flying and a bit of bombing on the bombing range and things like that. And then flew back on the 21st. 29th of November, yes. Having the last sortie I did was November the 1st. So why so long, I don't know, but anyway, they kept us there.
But you'd been aware of the whole build-up for quite some months, had you, before?
Well, since we were recalled from Malaya, yes. We knew what it would be for, yes. Operation Musketeer. When I got back, then they had a reorganisation and decided to put the Canberras into bigger squadrons with a wing commander, CO, and squadron leader flight commanders. So 101 squadron was temporarily disbanded till later when it became a Vulcan squadron. And I went to number nine squadron, and
was that early 57 or was it?
That was 56, 57, yes, yeah.
So what were nine squadron operating? Were they the same
aircraft and was on the same station? So our CO went as a flight commander. Now instead of CO, several of went to 9 squadron, some went to 12 squadron, and
so was it almost operating as a wing then? Is that how it, you know?
Well, it was a bigger squadrons, yes. Things were starting to change in that the squadron entity was beginning to disintegrate in a way that centralised servicing and things like that were beginning to come in. Whereas you had your squadron, you had your own aircraft, you had your own ground crew, had your own aeroplane, in fact. And the writing was on the wall that this was beginning to disappear because it's considered inefficient, I suppose. And the first step to this was to make bigger squadrons so they had more flexibility, I suppose, within the squadron.
Would the squadrons have more aircraft then?
Yes.
So your normal 16. Squadron was 12, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think we had 16 in the wing commander squadrons. My boss was a chap called Wing Commander Beresford Horsley. He'd just come from being an aide to Prince Philip.
Was he another wartime?
Yes.
Officer.
Yes. An excellent fellow. I liked him because he did a lot for me, actually. Because coming up then was the Vulcan was beginning to appear on the scene, and we had to apply if we wanted to go onto the Vulcan, and you had to have a certain amount of four engine experience and the jet tour, which I had with the camera as well. But I was only a flying officer, and as far as I was concerned, I had the qualifications to be a captain on the Vulcan. But when the posting came initially, it was to say I was to go as a co-pilot. So I saw the CO, and within a few days it was changed. So he had some pull with, I think the AOC was Gus Walker. You may have heard of him. And he changed his mind, and I was able to go on the on number six course at Waddington on the Vulcan Mark One.
Prior to that, Eric, though, can you tell me a little bit more about the time with 9 Squadron?
Yes.
What that involved, and in how long you were with them, what it involved, that sort of stuff, yeah?
Well, it was just all training stuff. I've got here bombing, cross-country, visual bombing. Visual bombing at El Adam. Trip to Gibraltar there for some reason or other.
So would you sometimes then go further afield? Because that was, prior to that, I was thinking of, for your exercises.
Yeah.
Would you sometimes go abroad for bombing exercises?
Only to Malta. We used to go to Malta, yes. Quite frequently.
And is that taken as a whole part of the exercise, the movement of the aircraft?
As a squadron,
and
yeah.
And then the bombing and...
As a squadron with its coming ground crew and all the rest of it, yes. Transport aircraft supporting, carrying them.
So is that training itself?
Part of mobility, if you like, mobility training. And operating under different conditions, different parts of the world.
So there is an element to that because, of course, you've operated in the tropics and you've operated in the deserts operationally, haven't
yeah.
you? But is that something that is then built into that training for the squadron? This idea that you can deploy quickly?
Yes, that was one of the requirements, yes. Yes, Malta comes in quite a lot. We did quite a few detachments to Malta.
And how long would that really involve when you do a detachment to Malta? What was the sort of timescales you'd be looking at?
See if we can figure it out. Difficult to tell, really, but it would be several weeks. Obviously, it wasn't worth going just for a short time, so it'd probably be a month or something like that, yes.
And that, again, works everybody up, does it, right across the squadron?
Yes.
And when you went on detachment to Malta, would you go into an existing airfield as such and just take over
the... Lucca, yes. We're going to Lucca, which was the main airport there, yes.
And there was adequate sort of training ranges?
Oh, yes, there's a bombing range at Filfla out there, and plenty of open sea, of course, to carry out all sorts of exercises. And we'd go across to Gibraltar occasionally, pick up duty-free.
And I take it this time, because obviously what you've said about that, you, were you interested in converting to the Vulcan?
Oh yes, yes, very much so.
Why was that? Why was your, where did your interest been sparked from?
Well, it was the new, the new aircraft. It was a movement on. It was progressing my career, if you like. I always liked to fly new aeroplanes.
And you, obviously at that stage, you've got quite a lot of experience on the Canberra, haven't you?
Yes. I'd completed a tour then on the Canberra, yes.
Now, you mentioned obviously there that the squadron commander was very helpful in that. Was that him, really him putting you forward? Would he need to...
Yes, we filled in with the necessary information on the application form and hours flown and what types and all the rest of it, and experience, and then it would go via him and up to group level, and they would make the decision up there.
And it's partly on his recommendation as well, is it? As your commander,
yes.
that helps that That's move right, that yes. process along.
Yes. Okay.